The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So, we'll have the opportunity to connect with Matthew Quick through his body of work, you know, Silver Linings Playlist, Sort of Like a Rock Star, Board 21, The Good Luck of Right Now. But I think Matthew Quick, a.k.a. Q, is more impressive actually in his own right, movie deals and bestsellers aside. He's the kind of person that looks you in your eye, that shakes your hand, that respects you simply on your own merit of being a fellow human being. He's the kind of person who's very genuine and present and easy to connect with. I guess you might sum him up as being a stand-up guy. The first time I met him was through the Teen Author Series, another program that the Free Library of Philadelphia and the generous Field family helps to support. And we were at the Frankfurt branch. It was 2010, and it was for his first YA book, Sort of Like a Rock Star. And his openness and his humility, his groundedness, they were just captivating. I remember telling him that he sort of had like a Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez kind of vibe. And it was really because he possessed a certain gravity, a certain depth about him that sort of reminded me of those two in particular. He clearly was not caught up in any roles or any boxes. It was that he had this sort of essence about him of living his own truth, sort of living outside the boxes that we often fall into of who, what, and when we should be. And so this in and of itself is a feat, sort of freeing yourself from being typecast. You know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, you've all heard this before, to be yourself in a world that is constantly trying to make you something else is the greatest accomplishment. But he was speaking to teenagers. He talked about facing his fears and facing his loved ones. He talked about shedding the safety and the comfort of the life that he was living at the time for something more meaningful, something that was imbued with purpose. The kind of purpose that defines your life because it is what you exist to do. And naturally, the teens, with their very keen radar for fraudulence, they were enthralled. He was the rock star. You know, he was signing books and posters and forearms of Philadelphia high school students. And so we had young ladies from Little Flower, and we had students from Community Academy. We had students from Frankfurt High School. So we were a very diverse audience, if you will. but the beautiful part, was that what he was sharing, it was his truth. I'll say that part again. It was his truth. You know, he's born in Philly, raised in Jersey, so he's sort of a local fella. And it's always nice to have one of your own come home. So if you would please welcome Matthew Quick to the stage.
Wow. That was a fantastic introduction. Aurora, that's our program here that she's involved with, the team program, is just absolutely phenomenal. They do such good work in Philadelphia, and I'm so proud to be a part of it two times. I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. It means a lot to me. Tonight is the official publication date of my fifth novel, The Good Luck of Right Now. I'm pausing because I'm like recognizing faces in the audience, and I'm like, and so I'm like seeing who's here. When my publicist at HarperCollins said to me, where do you want to launch? You know, what city do you want to launch? And we're doing a 10-city tour. Without hesitation, I said Philly, you know, because this is my home. I wanted to come home. I wanted to do it here. And I wanted to be at the Free Library as well. I've had the good fortune of being supported by them over the years, which is beautiful. And I've come here many times to hear my heroes speak. Most notably, I came to hear Kurt Vonnegut speak here on the stage. I was in the overflow room, so I wasn't in this room. I was watching on a screen somewhere else. And actually, backstage in the green room is a picture of Kurt Vonnegut. And he's a hero of mine. So to be on the stage where he was once is just absolutely, you know, mind-blowing and fantastic. I also came here to see Justin Cronin speak most recently, my former teacher. And I remember seeing Anne Lamott here. And each time I came, I thought, will I ever make it up onto this stage? You know, so this is quite a big moment for me. So I thank you for sharing it. I'm here to talk about the good luck of right now. I'm going to do a very brief reading to kind of set up the theme of the novel, and then I'm going to talk about the novel, and then we're going to do a Q&A, and we'll dialogue for a while. So the piece that I'm going to read is from the middle of the book, and it's just a few paragraphs. And again, it sets up the theme not only for the novel, but where I was when I was writing the novel as well. The book is written as letters to Richard Gere. Yes, Richard Gere, the actor, and I'll talk about that in a second. And the person writing these letters is a man named Bartholomew Neal, who, after 38 years of knowing nothing but living with his mother, is forced to confront the world on his own. When his mother, at the end of her life, gets dementia, she starts calling him Richard, and he has no idea why she would call him Richard until she passes, and he finds a letter, a Free Tibet letter, from Richard Gere in her underwear drawer. And he thinks it's a sign, and so he starts to write these letters to Richard Gere. So I always have trouble with the book, you know, holding it, so I photocopied a piece of paper here because I'm very professional. So this is in Bartholomew's voice. I have to say that everything seems to be unraveling lately, or maybe it seems as though I'm a flower myself, opening up to the world for the first time. I don't know why this is, and I'm not really in control of it either. Flowers do not think, okay, it is now May, so I'll reach up towards the sun and relax my fist of petals into an open hand. They do not think at all. Flowers just grow, and when it is time, they shoot colors out of their stems and become beautiful. I am no more beautiful than I was when Mom was alive, but I feel as though I am a fist opening, a flower blooming, a match ignited, a beautiful mane of hair loosened from a bun. That so many things previously impossible are now possible. And I've been wondering if that is the reason I did not cry and become upset when Mom died. Do the colorful flower petals cry and mourn where they are no longer contained within a green stem? I wonder if the first 38 years of my life were spent within the stem of me, myself. I've been wondering about a lot of things, Richard Gere. So, oh, thank you. You can break out in applause at any time. During my talk is wonderful. It'll encourage me. So I've started doing media already for this book. And the two questions that come up immediately are, A, why did you write this as a book of letters? And the second logical question I'm sure you'll guess is, why Richard Gere? So I'm going to tell stories about why I decided to frame the book the way that I did to start off. The first story has to do with fan mail. Actually, there's a couple stories about fan mail. When I was at Goddard, when I was doing the MFA, Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, I spent 2 years trying to get published in literary magazines. And I spent a small fortune in postage sending my essays and short stories to pretty much every literary magazine in the United States of America. And I received many, many, many rejections, and I managed to get, you know, about a half dozen publications that I was really proud of. The funny part about this story is that I really thought that this was the stepping stone to getting a book published in New York. And so I made a resume of all of my, you know, accomplishments. And when I got my agent, I printed it out and sent it to him in the mail. My agent is Doug Stewart at Sterling Lord Literistic. He's fantastic, and he's definitely made my career. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, Q, he called me on the phone. He's like, I got your list of publications. He goes, that's great, but like nobody cares about that in New York. And it's like, after 2 years of working, you know, trying to get this, it was all for naught. But I was really proud of those publications, and I published 2 essays in a magazine called The Sun, which is out of North Carolina. And it's a wonderful magazine with black and white photos, and they print poems and short stories and essays. And one of the essays that I wrote was called One Cigarette a Day. And it was about my grandfather losing a battle with emphysema after smoking his entire life. It was also about how I was kind of transitioning out of my smoking phase in college. And really what it was about was realizing that people and the things that you love are ephemeral for the first time. Not really a profound message, you know, in the grand scheme of things, but it was one of those pieces where, you know, I cut a vein and just bled all over the page. You know, it was when I was a piece when I was first really emotionally vulnerable for the first time. And so I was really, really proud of this piece. And I put it out into the world, and I was really nervous about what my family would think and my friends would think. And it came out, and I got my first piece of fan mail. And I was so excited. You know, I was so excited. It came from the Sun. And I remember opening it up, and it was from this man who is older than I was. He was at the end of his life, and he said, "Dear Mr. Quick, I've read your essay, One Cigarette a Day in the Sun. I, too, used to be a smoker when I was in Korea in the Army, and therein ended any reference to my essay whatsoever." The guy went on to tell me his life story, which had nothing to do with my essay, all the work that he had done for the government, and it ended with a multi-page mathematical equation that was supposed to prove that deep space travel was possible. Now, I'm not a mathematician, but when I looked over this equation, it looked pretty legit to me. You know, it looked like that. You know, this was this guy's life work. And he said at the end, you know, I hope this, you know, greets you well, and, you know, good luck with everything. And I started to think, why did this guy write me this long letter and present to me his life's work when it had nothing to do whatsoever with my essay? I couldn't figure out how to respond to this guy appropriately, but the letter stayed with me. And I thought, did he just send, you know, this type of letter all over the country to people who are publishing in magazines? Or was it specifically me? You know, was it something about me? And I also thought, you know, was it that he couldn't tell these things to the people that he was living with or sitting with, that he felt safer to write this to a stranger? Fan mail got increasingly intense when I started to publish novels. I used to have my email address on my website, and when Silver Linings came out and then my YA books, I just started to get bombarded with emails. And at first I tried to respond to everyone. I feel really guilty if I don't write back to someone. And then my wife said to me, you know, if you don't want to be divorced, you should take your email address off of your website, because you're spending far too much time on this. And it was troublesome because so many people were writing me, and it wasn't really about my work at all. Sometimes they would write a few lines, and they would say, "Here's what I love about your work," and I love getting those emails. Those are wonderful. And sometimes they would say, "Like, here's what I don't like about your work," and I never want to get those emails from anyone, FYI. But then it would be like this long list of this really personal stuff about their lives. And when I started to publish YA, teenagers would write me these just heartbreaking letters about the most personal, intimate details of their lives. And it was stuff that I knew that they weren't telling their friends, they weren't telling teachers, they weren't telling counselors, they weren't telling the people around them. And the interesting thing about it was, a lot of times, and I get them now through my agent, so they're through snail mail, so they're actually handwritten, and they'll open up with things like, "I know you'll never read this, so here we go." Or, "I know your agent's going to shred this." Or, "I know it'll never get through your people, so I might as well tell you everything about my life." And again, some of these emails and some of these letters are just so heartbreaking. And it's become apparent to me that they're not writing to me as a person. They're writing to me as a concept. They think of me as a published author, or as a published figure, or an ideal. Some of them think of me as something they want to be, a published author in the future. And it's almost as if they're throwing a penny in a wishing well, and they never expect to see that penny ever again. I know this because sometimes I write back postcards to these people, and they will write my assistant and say, "I can't believe that he wrote me back." And sometimes it's not in a good way. They'll say, like, "I can't believe he actually read that letter. Tell him not to tell anybody about that stuff I wrote." You know, like, it's like shocking to them that I actually would read, that I'm actually a real person with feelings. And so as I thought about all of this, I started to realize that, you know, when people write to celebrities or they engage with these, like, fictional ideas of people, they sometimes reveal a piece of themselves that they wouldn't reveal to their best friend or their spouse or the person sitting right next to them on a daily basis. And so writing these letters became a way for me to allow Bartholomew to tell his truth, to be raw, to be honest in a way that he wouldn't to the person, to the people that were in his life. So next question is, why Richard Gere? Why Richard Gere? People ask me, you know, "Are you a huge Richard Gere fan?" I like Richard Gere. You know, he seems like a very nice guy. I liked him more and more as I researched him. Some people will say, I'm not reading your book because I hate Richard Gere. And that really disappoints me. But the reason why I picked Richard Gere was because I received a letter from Richard Gere a while ago. And I came home from work one day, and my wife said to me, somebody famous wrote you a letter. And this was before Silver Linings or the movie, or, you know, I'd met actual celebrities before. This was pre all of that, so I was very excited. You know, I thought, oh, a celebrity wrote me, Matthew Quick. So I rushed in the kitchen to open it, and immediately it was one of those free Tibet letters. And I don't know if, you know, Richard Gere actually wrote it or not, or somebody, you know, said they were Richard Gere. But I said, this is a form letter. You know, I looked at my wife, and she's like, haha, I got you. But then I read the whole letter. You know, I sat there and read it, and when I finished, I'm like, why did I read this whole letter? You know, why did I read the whole thing? And then I thought about it, and I thought, you know, it's kind of cool to think that maybe Richard Gere, it's not Richard Gere. And I started to think about the power of celebrity. You know, just the idea that somebody famous would contact me made me open that letter and read it. You know, there was some part of me that was just eager to connect with something that I thought was bigger than me. And so Bartholomew is this guy who's really lonely, and he's desperate, and he wants to reach out, and he wants to figure out what's going on in the world. When his mother passes, the only thing that he has to view the world with is her Catholicism. That's the only thing he has, is inherited Catholicism. When he starts to write to Richard Gere and research Richard Gere's life, he discovers Buddhism and the Dalai Lama, and he starts to read about the Dalai Lama. He also, by going to the library here in Philadelphia, also starts reading about Jungian philosophy and synchronicity, the concept of synchronicity. I am not an expert on Jungian philosophy, and neither is Bartholomew. So simply put, synchronicity is the idea that two separate events could be related, not by their cause, but by their meaning to an individual. Simply put, we call this coincidence. And synchronicity and coincidence abounded when I was writing this book. I've heard people say, you know, if you look for something, you'll see it over and over again, but it happened in really weird ways. Synchronicity and coincidence also happened on my journey towards becoming a professional writer as well. My agent says to me all the time, he's like, Q, he's like, things work out for you in the weirdest ways, because I've never seen it happen before. I'm not sure what that means. But I became kind of obsessed with thinking about synchronicity. Also, when I was writing this book, it was a time when my life was changing radically and very fast. It's one thing to dream of being a published writer with movie deals in L.A. It's another thing to see your first book being adapted into a movie that's going to win an Oscar. And I wrote this book at a time when I was going through that transition. People were asking me really tough questions. I would have interviews, and people would say, why your books? Why are people picking you? And I didn't really have a good answer for that. You know, I had plenty of other writer friends who had worked just as hard as I did, who were just as talented. And I had young authors come up to me and say, what is the formula for making it? And of course, like, there is no formula. Like, I didn't know what the formula is. And I started to obsess about these things. And, you know, I actually lost sleep about this at some points. And so I started to use Bartholomew as a way to kind of explore the rhythms of the universe in kind of a fun way. I'm going to tell you one story about synchronicity that has to do with the writing of the book, and then I'm going to tell you one story about synchronicity that has to do with my personal life. The one with the book is fun. I wrote the entire book, and it's not too much of a spoiler to say that my characters go on a road trip in the middle of the novel, and they don't have a car, so they have to rent a car. And a lot of people might believe that Ford was paying me to do product placement in my novels. But this is not true. I never got a check from Ford. When I was an English teacher, I used to tell my students, you know, like every decision an author makes has great symbolic value and meaning. And then I became an author, and I realized that 95% of the things that you write, you just pick out of your head randomly. And maybe subconsciously it means something. And so when it came time to put these characters in a car, I just chose randomly a Ford Focus. You know, maybe I was conscious of the alliteration there would be. One of my characters is fond of another F word that he likes to throw in, so it was good alliteration. But there was no other reason for that. So Alicia read the manuscript. She's my first reader. And she said, we should go on that road trip. We should go on that road trip, and we should research. She's really good on the sentence level. She's much more of a poet than I am. So we often go to the scenes where my books take place and do research and details. It's a lot of fun. I think she really just wanted to go on a road trip, too, to be honest with you. So I said, okay, let's do everything that they do. Let's rent a car. And so we went to the car rental place, and we get there. So, Mr. Quick, what car would you like? And I said, just give me any car. It doesn't matter. You know, economy car. And 5 minutes later, they roll around. Mr. Quick, here's the keys to your Ford Focus. True story. It was absolutely bizarre. What does that mean in the grand scheme of the universe? I can't tell you. But I can tell you that for the first hour of that trip, Alicia and I laughed and smiled, and the coincidence, or the synchronicity, if you will, really heightened the meaning of that trip. It's one thing to have that coincidence happen to you. It's another thing to write a book about synchronicity and then have that happen to you. Very, very interesting. The other story I'd like to tell you takes us back in time. And before I tell this story, for the people who've already read the book, you'll immediately realize why it's relevant. For the people who haven't read the book, when you buy your copy tonight and you read tonight, you'll figure it out. My publisher tells me to say that. That was a good joke. Come on, people. I'd ask you not to spoil it for the people who haven't read. So this story takes us back to my junior year in Collingswood High School, when I was in the French class, and I don't know how I made it to French 4, because I was an absolutely terrible French student. I would like to preface this by saying that my French teachers in junior high and in high school were absolutely wonderful people and fantastic teachers. The fault is mine. And every time I go to France or French Canada, I feel much shame for not taking it more seriously. But as a joke, my classmates voted me the vice president of the French club, much to the horror of my teacher. And so I have to go to these meetings, and I love my French class. I like to read the books that we were studying, but I secretly read them in English. So it's when I first discovered Camus and the Petit Prince. I love the books, and I kind of just faked my way through French class. And so when my French teacher said, we're going to go to French Canada, as a class, I thought to myself, this is not for me, because A, I can't speak French. B, I'd never left the country before. I don't even think I'd been to New York City. I'd been to North Carolina and Florida, but we'd never been abroad. We weren't poor, but we didn't have a lot of money then either, so I didn't know if my parents would go for this. But I remember my mom, she's here, she's right here tonight. We can give my mom a round of applause. Make her embarrassed, come on. She said to me, this is a good thing, you should go on this trip. You should go on this trip to French Canada. And so I found myself on a bus going north. And this was a time when I was first starting to have these strange feelings in here and in here. Like in retrospect, I know I can look back and say I was dealing with depression and anxiety, but I didn't know what that was back then. So I just thought it was a strange thing I was supposed to hide. And one of the ways that I dealt with that was by putting on headphones and kind of blocking out the world. So I remember on my trip up to French Canada, I was listening to really depressing music like The Cure and just kind of staring out the window, at the white barren land going by. And we got to Montreal, and I was a little nervous because I'd never been out of the country. And one of the first places that they took us was this place called St. Joseph's Oratory. If you've never been to Montreal, I highly recommend that you go. The view from the balcony up there, it's up on a hill, is just gorgeous. Just that alone is worth going. And so we go into St. Joseph's Oratory, and we're told that it was built by a man named Brother André Bessette, and that he was a miracle worker, that he healed people by the laying on of hands. And we were told that he built this place in honor of St. Joseph. And people still come from all around the world, and you can light a candle, you have to pay a dollar, but you can light a candle, and you can pray to St. Joseph for a miracle. And so we walked in, and we saw all these red candles, and I was raised Protestant. Catholicism was way out of my comfort zone. And so I walk in, I see all these candles, and I see people praying for miracles. And I'm like, okay, I'm taking a step back. We walk into another room, and there's all these crutches on the wall donated by people that had been miraculously healed by Brother André, who has since been canonized as a saint. And at this point, a classmate of mine, who is a self-proclaimed atheist, he says, he just yelled, he's like, this is bullshit, I'm out of here. And he just walks out. He said, I'm an atheist. I shouldn't have to be here. This is a public school. And he left to go smoke cigarettes in the parking lot. At this point, I almost went with him because I thought I was Protestant. This is a lot of Catholicism. I'm not interested in this. But there was I felt drawn to this place. And I remember we went upstairs and they had these wooden carvings of the disciples that were elongated and almost looked alien. And I remember trying to find Matthew for obvious reasons because I'm Matthew and that's how my brain works. And I remember just looking at it and feeling like this is a strange, like almost like a holy place. I felt like kind of drawn to it. And then the tour guide took us into this other room, and it looked like a bank vault. And there was this red light shining down. It was glass, and there were these metal doors that open up. And there was this pillar, and there was this glass container. And inside the glass container was a human heart. Okay, for a Protestant kid, this was like way out of my comfort zone. Okay, and I said, this is Brother Andre Bessette's heart. We cut it out of him when he died, and we put it on display. And so I'm thinking, why? Like, why did you do this? I'm thinking, who was Brother Andre? Who was his family? Like, it just really made an impression on me, and I couldn't get it out of my head. We went to French Canada, and we went to Quebec. We went to Winter Carnival. I came home, went through the summer, and then the beginning of my senior year, something else very strange happened. My grandfather, who was uber Protestant, said to me, you know what? I have a friend on the board at LaSalle. You ought to look at LaSalle University. It's a good college. This was a strange thing for my grandfather to say because LaSalle is a Catholic university. And I remember going to LaSalle and, you know, going there and seeing all the Christian brothers, you know, wearing, you know, the black and white outfits. I remember seeing statues of Mary. They had one called the Walking Madonna in the quad, and it looked like Mary had been, like, burned. It was a very odd statue. It's not on the quad anymore because LaSalle found out it was worth a lot of money. So they put it in their art museum. It's a true story. And there were crucifixes in all of the classroom. And again, as a Protestant kid, it felt very much out of my comfort zone. But I thought to myself, this is the place for me. And I went to LaSalle, and my freshman year, I met some really good people. One of my best friends, Eric Smith, he works at Fox. I met him that year. But I wasn't really prepared for high school. College. I didn't try that hard in high school. And so it was a rough year for me. Most kids gain 15 pounds freshman year. I lost 30 pounds. Like by the end of freshman year, I was 135. And I remember, I was feeling very anxious and kind of hiding that from my friends. And I remember the last 2 weeks of school, I was just alone in my dorm room, chain smoking clove cigarettes, listening to The Cure, you know, wondering what was wrong with me. So it was a really kind of low point. I thought, why did I come to LaSalle? I spent the summer roofing, and then the next year I made some new friends. And I joined a band, and we started playing music. And my bandmate was a guitarist by the name of Andy, and he met a freshman girl named Shelly, and Shelly happened to have a friend named Alicia. Now, Alicia says we met at the track house. I don't remember that. I remember meeting over breakfast. But the one thing that we both remember is very early on having a date at intermissions at LaSalle. They had the best hot wings, Peaches wings. They're fantastic. And we have people that remember here, so validating the story. And I remember sitting with Alicia getting to know her. She was 17. And she said to me, you know, I happen to be of French-Canadian descent. I almost went to school in Montreal. She wanted to go to McGill. And I said, oh, really? I said, I went to Montreal, and I went to this place called St. Joseph's Oratory. It was the wildest place. I said, you have to go there someday. And I'm talking a mile a minute. I said, there's this guy, Brother Andre, and his heart's on display, and he healed people. I said, it's this most, you know, interesting place I've ever been. And Alicia says, yeah, Brother Andre Bessette. I said, yeah. And she said, Alicia Bessette. And she said, that's my great, great, great uncle. Directly related. She, to this day, she carries a little medal of Brother Andre around when we travel. She's a swath of his cloth. It's a very holy place for her family. Two of her aunts were nuns. When he was canonized as a saint, it was a very, very big deal to her. Alicia came to LaSalle because she wanted a liberal arts school in a city that had a French major, and she could double major in French and English. LaSalle had the tiniest French program. There's only a couple students in it, but it fit the bill. If LaSalle doesn't have a French program, Alicia doesn't come to LaSalle. I never meet her. If my grandfather, who's uber Protestant, doesn't encourage me to go to a Catholic school, which is really strange, I don't meet Alicia. If I don't meet Alicia, I'm not on this stage here today, because she's my first reader, she's my therapist, my cheerleader, my best friend. She edits all of my books. She's the one who encouraged me to write. She's the reason why I'm a fiction writer today. What does that mean in the grand scheme of things? I'm not sure I can tell you, but when I was writing The Good Luck of Right Now, one of the things that I started to realize is that sometimes when you let go, you take chances and allow yourself to be the leaf in the cosmic stream. Sometimes the right people show up in very weird ways. And as Alicia said to me in response when I was practicing this speech on her, she said, sometimes the weird people show up in the right ways. And I think the weird is, you know, in a very positive, positive concept. My wife is always one up on me. You know, I might as well just say she writes my novels. You know, she's much better than I am. And so I wrote this book at a time when my life was so surreal, and I was so grateful for all the things that were happening with Silver Linings. But it was a time when I was really questioning, you know, how the world works. You know, why me? What's going on with this? I needed to laugh. I needed to cry. I needed to work through some issues. I laughed and cried all the way through the writing of this book. It was a wonderful writing experience. And my hope for you when you read it is that you'll find it cathartic as well. I hope it leaves you a little better off than you were before you read it, and I hope it makes you smile. And so I am going to turn this over to the Q&A, and we can have a discussion. But I will say before we get to the Q&A, I was supposed to mention this, I almost forgot. We hope that you will read the book before the movie comes out, because DreamWorks is in casting right now, and I have amazing casting news that I'm like not allowed to share with you. It's like torture. And next Tuesday, I'll be meeting in L.A. with the directors, Dayton and Farris, who directed Little Miss Sunshine. So it's very exciting. I'm very, very excited. Thank you so much.
Is Alicia your wife?
No, she's just some girl that lives with me. Yeah, I probably should have said that. Alicia's my wife. Yeah, she is. She is my wife. We've been married for maybe 17 years this year. We've been together for 21 years since we were kids at LaSalle. She was 17, I was 19 when we met, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. So that was an easy question. I hope they're all like that. Yeah, right over here.
Just a question about the letters. I noticed not only in this, obviously, but in Leonard Peacock, Silver Linings, the letters are a recurring thing.
Yeah.
How did you kind of arrive at that as a mechanism?
You know, it's...
I understand now for this one, because you explained that.
Yeah, no. Like, letters do come up a lot. I spent a lot of my teen years writing to a pen pal that I met in North Carolina. I just actually wrote an essay. It was in Coastal Living last month. It talked a lot about this. And so writing letters was how I learned to write. I also think there's something really intimate about writing a letter as well. It's kind of a lost art. You know, I sound like I'm a million years old, kids now. But teenagers, you know, they send emails. And there's something about like sitting down and composing a letter, especially by hand, that I think is a lost art. I find myself, you know, with my characters, I like them to write letters because I feel like they behave differently in a letter than they do with dialogue. And sometimes, like I said before, sometimes we tell the truth in a letter in a way that we won't. It's kind of a one-sided dialogue. Like, you have a lot of room to pontificate. And sometimes with my characters, too, there are often people that society isn't listening to. You know, there are people that aren't getting a say. They're the people that are kind of neglected. So when you allow them to write letters, they can get everything out in a way that they might not be able to get out in conversation, which I think is important. But I can't say that I consciously sit down and say, I'm going to write a letter in every single one of my books. It's not how I work. You know, I usually just write in whatever comes out.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, like, I know I haven't read The Good Luck of Right Now yet. I'm really excited about it. But
thank you.
And Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock, it was a lot about, you know, someone struggling. Like, pretty much the whole book is like a struggle. Do you feel like The Good Luck of Right Now is not a sequel, but kind of like a companion in that, like what you said, the theme of like growing and like blossoming, like, do you think it's kind of like Leonard Peacock was struggling and now Bartholomew is growing? Do you feel like there's like that connection there between those two books?
Yeah, I mean, like the most obvious answer is that all of my books are connected by me, right? You know, and I think that a lot of my work is about what's going on in here and here. I always tell people, I was saying this in the cocktail hour upstairs, that when I write, I take all the chaos in here and in here and try to make order on the page. The interesting thing about, you know, having five novels out now, and I have a sixth that's already done that'll come out next year, is that my audience is now looking at my body of work rather than just one book. And sometimes that can be daunting, you know, because, you know, people are starting to expect certain things from me. But I often look at it, you know, I kind of take a positive view of it, that I'm starting to learn more about myself, too. I say that I don't really know what my novels are about until I publish them and put them into the world. You know, I'll finish a book and it'll be done. And it's really when it's reviewed and people read it and I get the response and there's that dialogue that I really kind of figure out what I was doing or what I was going for. When I'm in the moment, I feel, you know, I'm just channeling. And of course, like, I'm conscious of what I'm doing. But you have kind of room to psychoanalyze yourself after something's come out. I don't feel that I've had enough time with Good Lucker Right Now yet. With Leonard Peacock, I feel like I have. And that book has been illuminated for me in many different ways as people have read it and responded. So, you know, I think you just can't help it. You know, sometimes I worry about that. But then I look at all of my heroes. Like, I love Haruki Murakami. Like, he's one of my favorite writers. And if I read Haruki Murakami, I know there's going to be a talking cat in the book. I know that there's going to be, like, really surreal things. There's going to be existential crisis. I know all of the things that make a Haruki Murakami book. But I love that. You know, I think that's what he has to offer the world. That's his truth. And so when I'm writing my books, I want it to be my truth. And when I finish my book, the first thing I do is I ask Alicia to read it. And I don't ask her, is this book good? I ask her, is this book authentically me? And if she says yes, I put it into the world, you know, because that's the best I can do.
Hello, how are you? I enjoyed your talk very much.
Oh, thank you.
I'm wondering if when you write, particularly the Silver Linings Playbook, if you're aware that there are a lot of scenes in it that would really go over well in a film, such as the dance contest, the scene at the diner. I mean, does that cross your mind? Did that cross your mind, or...
You know, when I was writing Silver Linings Playbook, I was an unpublished author living with my in-laws and with, you know, no money to my name. I had made a penny in years. And I never thought, I mean, I dreamed that someday people would make movies out of my books, but it was never like I sat down and said, okay, like, here we go. Like, this is the book that's going to be made into an Oscar-winning film. People say that my work is cinematic, and I think the reason for that is that I watch a lot of film and I love a lot of film. One, you know, talk about synchronicity. I remember when I was writing Silver Linings Playbook, going to see Little Miss Sunshine in the theater and having this breakthrough because in the MFA program, like, when you're in academia, like, you're taught, like, you should write highbrow literature and anything else is ridiculous. And I kind of bought into that for a while. And so I was really trying to write this, like, really highbrow literature. And Silver Linings Playbook was my secret, like, I'm ashamed of this project that I'm not going to tell my advisors about. And when I saw Little Miss Sunshine, I remember thinking, like, this is what I want to do. Like, this is what I love. Like, these are the stories that I want to tell. And when I made that decision, I really went forward with, you know, putting Silver Linings in the world. What's interesting, and talk about synchronicity, is that I'm going to be meeting next week with the people who directed that film. You know, so I think that, you know, you have certain stories in you to tell. And I think you have to be authentic about the type of stories that you want to tell. So I've been heavily influenced by film, you know, and I'm lucky enough that people in L.A. want to work with me. So it's not like I sit down and say, like, okay, what's the next, you know, blockbuster movie? I sit down and say, let me tell the best story I can and make it work as a book first. Yeah, you're welcome.
Hi, do you approach writing for young adults differently than you do your regular novels?
No, I really don't. The only thing that's different, as far as I'm concerned, writing YA or writing my adult novels, is the age of my protagonist. So in order for it to be YA, it has to be a teenage voice telling the story. It's got to be about, the arc has to be about a teenager. Besides that, there's nothing different. You know, I was talking about genre snobbery earlier in the MFA and academia and all of that. When I first published Silver Linings, my agent, I was in New York. We had just met with Sarah Crichton. We just had lunch, and it was 105 degrees. It was on a park bench in New York, and trying not to sweat in front of all these important people. And my agent says to me, you should write YA. And I remember my response to him was, I don't do genre. Like, very snobby, like, that's not for me. Like, you know, this is, I went through the MFA. Like, I'm an important person. Like, I don't write YA. I really regret saying that because there's really great YA out there. There's really great realistic YA. I was just talking backstage with Aurora about Amy King, A.S. King writes fantastic YA. I could go on and on. Matt LaPena is a friend of mine. Evan, James Roscoe's, his wife is right here, a good friend of mine, writing fantastic YA. But at the time, I was really ignorant about that. And my agent's response when I said that, he said, Catching a Ride, J.D. Salinger, that's YA. It's from the point of view of a teenager. And I remember thinking, wow, I could be J.D. Salinger. That sounds good, you know? But it was like I had to kind of get over that genre snobbery, and it really bums me out. Like sometimes when I read reviews of my adult work, like they'll mention that. They'll say, oh, this is the guy who writes YA, as if like it's some type of crime. You know, I think if you're a storyteller, you should be telling stories for everybody. Like what's wrong with that? You know, what's wrong to tell stories for teenagers or adults? I'm really proud of all of my YA books. Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock was published as an adult book in Brazil, and it's doing very well down there as an adult book. We almost published it as an adult book in the U.S. It's just marketing. It's just where is it going to go in Barnes & Noble? That's really all it's about. Or the indies, preferably the indies.
I remember at your last talk in Cherry Hill, you said that there was a time, I think it was right after Silver Linings, where you were actually thinking of giving up writing and going back to being a counselor, like maybe becoming a counselor. Do you, even though you're busy writing books, do you still have that like desire to work with kids again, like hands-on?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I miss working with kids. You know, I was never officially a counselor. You know, I counseled troubled teens when I was working as a high school teacher. I do miss it. And when I go and work with teens, you know, even with the program of the Philadelphia Free Library, or Free Library Philadelphia, I'm always messing that up. You know, whenever I get around teens, I feel guilty about not teaching anymore. And my wife is always quick to remind me that, you know, you're still teaching, you know, and not that my books are didactic, but they are an extension of my philosophy that I'm putting into the world. I get letters from my former students all the time, you know, and sometimes they'll find my books and they'll say, you know, Q, like this is exactly the stuff you were talking about in lit class, or like it's, reading your book is like sitting in your class again. And I consider that a high compliment because I tried to put a philosophy forth in my classroom that was based on things that I believed in. And when I write my books, I do the same. I don't know, you know, there's times that I feel as though you know, writing is like is you empty yourself out. You know, you've got to put your best into the world. If you've never written a book and you've never published, you don't understand that. It's a very you're very exposed when you publish a book, and you know you take everything that's the best of you, everything that you love, and you put it on display, and then everybody reviews it and talks about it and picks it apart. And sometimes it's wonderful because you have like these really meaningful connections with people, and sometimes it's not so wonderful. And it takes a lot of energy. And a lot of my friends who are writers, they go through very serious depression after they publish a book. Friends that are women that write, they compare it to like postpartum. Like, you know, you put all this effort to put it into the world and then it's over and it's hard, you know? So there are times that I say to myself, I don't know if I have any more in me to do. And the other thing about publishing too is that you put your best in the world and most books do not succeed according to what New York wants them to do because it's about making money. And so you could write the best book in the world, but if it doesn't make people a lot of money, it's considered a failure. And that is very hard to deal with. When you take your art and it becomes a commodity, and you make it into a business, that can be very difficult. And even when you do succeed, the things that you're expected to do are not the things that you want to do. You know, if you're a fiction writer, you want to be alone in a room writing books. If you're a successful author, your publisher wants you to be on book tour and doing media and traveling, and all those things are wonderful in their own way, but you know, most of us want to be in a room writing books, you know. So it's you have to put on a lot of different hats, and for me to do this, I enjoy doing this, but it takes a lot of energy out of me. And so there's sometimes that I feel as though, you know, maybe I'll need a break at some point, you know, I don't know.
You've touched on depression a fair amount in books and in your talk. Do you have some suggestions for either teenagers or parents? Because there seems to be increased press attention about teenage and college students committing suicide.
You know, I think I hesitate to make any blanket statements about those things. You know, I feel that when you write about depression and mental health, there are a lot of people that come at you with political agendas. You know, they want, you know, it's, when Silver Linings was out, the movie, there were people who wanted to make it about, like, you should take medication. Other people wanted to make it about exercise, or other people would make it, you know, whatever they was their political platform, they really wanted to graft onto that. For me, as an educator and as a writer and as a public speaker, literature is really a unique place for us to promote empathy and promote emotional intelligence. When I was a teacher, you know, I saw again and again how fiction and talking about books was a very unique experience in a student's day as they went throughout the classroom. I have students that come to me to this day that say, like, you know, reading Catcher in the Rye or reading The Bell Jar or reading a certain book and talking about it in your class, like, saved my life. Like, they'll make statements like that. And for me, I know that, and I don't say this lightly, if I didn't leave teaching to pursue fiction writing full time, I do not think I would be in a good place right now. Like, fiction is something that I don't want to do. It's something that I need to do. And so for me, you know, fiction is a way to have these conversations. It's a safe place when we put on the mask of fiction to explore some of this stuff. I know for a fact that so many teenagers, when I was teaching at Haddonfield High School, as soon as I hooked them on fiction, they would write about their problems in their essays, they would come and they would talk to me, and they would tell me things that they would not tell their parents or their best friends. Kids that read my books, and kids that read A.S. King's books, or Evan Roscoe's books, or Matt DiLapena's books, they will read those books and have experiences because it validates what they're feeling. They think that they're alone in the world and no one else is going through these things. And when you read a fictional account of that, it makes you feel less alone. So I'm very much pro-fiction in schools. The sad thing, and not to get up on a soapbox here, is that this type of stuff, like empathy and emotional intelligence, is not what we measure in standardized testing at all, which is really a shame because it's an intelligence that we need. And when we have people, unfortunately, we hear every day of, like, you know, people, you know, going into schools with guns, people, you know, being frustrated. We need empathy and emotional intelligence more than ever. So I think, you know, that's why, you know, programs like the Free Library puts out, and, you know, teaching fiction in schools is so important. Wow, a slow clap there. Wow, thank you. Thank you for that. Yay, fiction.
Richard Gere, have you heard from him?
I have to think about how to answer this question, what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not allowed to say. We, of course, you know, fearing legal repercussions, were quick to send a copy of the book to Richard Gere through my people at DreamWorks. I know that he has the book. I haven't been contacted by Richard or his people, but I also know that they're not upset about it, which means that somebody vetted it. And there are rumors about him perhaps doing some type of cameo in the film, but they're not confirmed, and, you know, we're hoping for that. And so and I haven't been sued yet, so that's always good. It was that and the Dalai Lama too, and it was like, do you think the Dalai Lama will sue me? Probably not, you know. So I thought we were safe there.
Hi, you thanked your relatives for the Vermont House. So could you speak a little bit about your writing process and the Vermont House, please?
Yeah, the Vermont House, my in-laws have a house right outside of Okemo. It's a ski house, and it's a place that isn't used as much in the summer as it is in the winter, obviously. And so it's a place that Alicia and I go when we finish a manuscript. And there's a lake, just a small lake there, you know, about a mile away from the house that we go to, and we always edit there. It's kind of become a tradition. It's really just a way to switch it up. It's very quiet there. For a long time, there was no internet or no cable TV, but then my nieces and nephews grew up and demanded it, and so now there is internet and cable TV, which kind of spoiled it a little bit for us. But it was just kind of a change of pace, you know, a good place, something that felt like it was good energy. Whenever I get stuck, too, it's been a good place to go to get unstuck. I was horribly stuck on Boy 21, and Alicia and I got in the car and said, let's go to Vermont and just work it out for a week. And so we spread the pages out on the floor, and then we went to the lake and spread the pages out, and we just kind of hammered it out. So I think it's just really a safe place to get away and kind of forget about some things. I've also had the experience I was stuck with Leonard Peacock. I've told this story, you know, if you heard me speak about Leonard Peacock, where I got an invitation to go to the south of France from my friend Liz Jensen. And I said, I did not want to go there because I had to write this book. And And Alicia said, we are going there, or, you know, because we are going to France. And when I got to France and Paris, it was just immediately I became unstuck. And I became a bad guest because instead of hanging out with Karsten and Liz, I was outside writing, you know, because it was a change of pace. And I think with writing, it's largely psychological, you know. And my friend Liz, who's a wonderful writer, you should read her stuff. Her husband, Karsten, is also a fantastic writer. She always says to me, like, do whatever it takes. Like, do anything if it works. She said, if you have to drink a bottle of wine at 9 in the morning, do it. Like, whatever works. You know, not that I'm recommending that. But that's what she says over and over. Like, whatever you have to do to make it work, you know, switch up your routine, try things new. I think that that's really important for an artist. And I get frustrated when writers will say, you have to do this, this, and this in order to be a serious writer. Like, that's such a lie. Everybody has a different rhythm. Everybody has a different way of going about it. And there's no formula for making art. And so, you know, going to Vermont or going to France or whatever is just a way to shake it up.
Hello.
Hello.
I saw an interview with Tina Fey last night, and she talked about something that you posted recently on Twitter and Facebook, kind of indirectly, so I wanted to read it to you now and get your thoughts on it.
Sure.
When I began writing, if I knew then what I know now, I'm not sure I would have made it this far. Ignorance is a powerful tool for beginners, and if you could expand on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes young writers will come up to me and they'll say, I want to know everything about the publishing industry. Like, I want to know everything about working with people in LA. I want to know everything about publishing a book. And I'm always hesitant to tell them the truth. Because number one, it's just too much information to take in one sitting. And number two, a lot of the information is really daunting. You know, it's really, you know, if I knew how hard it was to make it in New York and LA, and how much work and sacrifice and how many great writers there are out there doing fantastic work that can't pay the bills. If I really understood that when I was a teacher at Haddonfield, I don't know that I would have taken the leap. I remember Rachel Pollack was my advisor at Goddard, and she was an expert on tarot. And I remember she gave a talk about the Fool card. And she said, you know, people think of the Fool as like when you pick up the Fool, like it's a bad thing. Because there's a picture of, you know, a man who's like kind of looking up at the clouds like a poet. And he's got one foot over the cliff and he's going to fall. And she said the reason why this is such a great card is because the Fool is willing to make the journey. You know, the people who are educated, they say, no, 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 you can't go in the forest. You can't take a risk because you're going to get hurt. The Fool has no concept of getting hurt. And so they take the risk. They're the ones that are going to do something different. And they're usually the ones that are going to be the people that create art. And so I think that, you know, MFA programs like a really great example. And I'm glad I did the MFA. It was a good experience for me. But when you go to an MFA, you learn from a lot of people who have been beaten up by New York and the publishing industry. And they have a lot of rules about what is good and what isn't good. And sometimes you can get really stuck by that. You can get really, really stuck. And, you know, I think that when you're ignorant, you know, you don't know what you're doing. And then sometimes that can be a good thing. You're willing to take that first step off the cliff because you don't know about the fall yet.
Hi, I really enjoyed your talk tonight.
Thank you.
I didn't read Silver Linings until I saw the movie, and then when I read the book, it was much different from the movie. And as an author, you sell you sell the rights to your book, and then you're not really sure what Hollywood's going to do with it. I know it was an Academy Award winner and everything, but are you pleased with the finished product?
I enjoyed David's adaptation. I think one of the things that really helps me as a professional is I'm pretty realistic about the business. When I went into, you know, the movie deal, like, I knew it was going to be an adaptation of my book. And I know what that means because I've read a lot of books that have been made into movies. Like, I know what the deal is. I also know that to tell a story on screen is a much different experience than telling a story in a book. Things that work in books don't work on the screen and vice versa. That being said, when David finished the film, he was convinced I would hate it. He was really afraid of my reaction. And it was to the point when I saw the film and I said, I really enjoyed it. You know, I talked to Bruce Cohen, who's also producing Good Luck, coincidentally. He said, you have to call David right away because he's completely freaking out. And I think when I told people, like, I enjoyed the film, like, they didn't believe me. Like, they were expecting, you know, me to be, like, the typical writer who's really angry about, you know, how dare you have done this to my work. My agent said to me, my LA agent, when we first did the deal, he said, Q, his name is Rich Green. He was at CAA at the time. He's now at Resolution. Great guy. He said, Q, he's like, one bit of advice. He said, don't think of this whole thing as anything except for a $30 million ad for your book. You know, and it was pretty much the best advice that he could have given me, you know. And of course, it's nice when it wins an Academy Award, and like I enjoyed the film. And when I went out into the world on tour with the Weinstein Company, that was also really interesting. They took me to Tribeca to see the film, and the Weinstein reps watched me watch the film. So I came in, and they said, you know, Harvey Weinstein really wants you to love this film. And if you love it, we're going to send you on tour to promote. And so then I'm watching it, and they're standing there literally, they're like watching me watch the film to see and reporting into Harvey. And it was such a surreal experience for me. And when I went on tour with the Weinstein Company, they were wonderful. It was great. We would do like a showing, and then afterwards I would do a Q&A like this. And what was so interesting to me about that experience is that people in the audience were crying at the end, and they were coming up to me, and they weren't saying, this is the best movie I've ever seen, or your book is amazing. They were saying, thank you for raising awareness about mental health issues. Thank you for putting this story into the world. And it was at that moment that I realized these conversations about, like, was the book better or the novel better, were completely irrelevant, that what we were doing had really transcended all of that. You know, don't get me wrong. Like, people in L.A., like, they want to win prizes. It's a business. They want to make money. But every single person I talked to that was involved with the filming of Silver Linings, some of them openly, like David talked openly about his son, and some of them were very private about it. They had very specific reasons for making that film, and none of them were, hey, let's see how much money we can make or how many Oscars. It was always, I know this person, or my son, or my daughter, or my wife, or me, and that's why I did this project. And so it was really, when you see that, you know, for me as a storyteller, it becomes like the story becomes more important than your own personal ego. It becomes, you know, obviously you want to do well career-wise, but I think in the truest sense, if you put your story out into the world, you hope that it puts as much good into the world as possible. And so the movie in conjunction with the book, it was a very powerful tool for that. And I think that we accomplished a lot. So I'm very proud of that. Matthew, one more. Okay, thank you. One more question I've been told.
Would you ever consider writing a screenplay for one of your novels?
Yes, I would. It was funny. It wasn't funny. It was kind of tragic. I've always dreamed of writing a screenplay. And when I was at the Oscars, the Weinstein party the night before the Oscars was for Django Unchained and Silver Linings. So all the actors there, you know, Jamie Foxx and Tarantino and all the people in our camp, and Dylan Sellers was at the bar. He works as a buyer for the Weinstein Company, and he said, Matthew Quick, come on over here, you know. And he said, I love Leonard Peacock. I want to buy this book. Like, it's amazing, you know. Like, it's just like L.A. treatment is fantastic. You know, you go to L.A. and your head gets huge. But he said, listen, I want you to write screenplay for Leonard Peacock. You know, I really would love you to write screenplay. I know you can do it. The problem was I was in negotiations with HarperCollins for my next two books, and they wanted two books in 2 years, which is a heck of a commitment. So when it came down, we sold the rights to Leonard Peacock to the Weinstein Company, and I actually had to tell Harvey Weinstein no, because I was already under contract with HarperCollins. 7 years ago, if you had told me that I would tell Harvey Weinstein that I'm not writing a screenplay for him, I would have never believed that in a million years. And so it was kind of a good problem to have. My agent in L.A., he says it's not a question of whether you will, it's a question of when. The other thing, too, is that if you write an adaptation of your book, they buy your book and then they hire you as an employee to adapt it, and they can make you do anything they want. You know, so Harvey Weinstein could read it and say, no, do it again, or change this or change that. Whereas if you write an original screenplay, they buy the screenplay as you have written it. So that's an important distinction. So James Ponsalt is writing the screenplay for Leonard Peacock. He just did The Spectacular Now, which I thought was fantastic. And Mike White has written the screenplay for The Good Lucker Right Now, and he's now writing the screenplay for my next novel, Love May Fail. He did a show called Enlightened in HBO, which was, I thought, absolutely fantastic. So I couldn't be happier with the people who are handling that for now. But in the future, I think I will. Yeah. So you've been a fantastic audience. Thank you so much.
I'll be signing books, and hopefully I'll see some of you out there.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.